With the new term, I got back to my tutorials in politics, including studies on the relevance of scientific theories to strategic planning. The problem of making a conscript army into a patriotic one from Napoleon to Vietnam, and the problems China and Russia posed for U.S. policy. I read Herman Kahn on the probabilities of nuclear war, different destruction levels, and post-attack behavior. It was strangelove-like and unconvincing. I noted in my diary that what happens after the fireworks begin may not pursue the set course of any scientific systems and analysts' models. Rick Stearns threw me for a loop one night when he told me I was unsuited for politics. He said Huey Long and I both had great Southern political styles, but Long was a political genius who understood how to get and use power. He said my gifts were more literary, that I should be a writer because I wrote better than I spoke, and besides, I wasn't tough enough for politics. A lot of people have thought that over the years. Rick was close to right, though. I had never loved power for power's sake, but whenever I got hit by my opponents, I usually mustered enough toughness to survive. Besides, I didn't think I could do anything else as well. In late May, I was accepted at Yale Law School and decided to go. On June the 26th, I took the plane to New York after emotional goodbyes. And just like that, it was over. Two of the most extraordinary years of my life. They began on the eve of Richard Nixon's election and ended as the Beatles announced they were breaking up and released their last movie to loving, mourning fans. I had traveled a lot and loved it. I had also ventured into the far reaches of my mind and heart, struggling with my draft situation and my ambivalence about my ambition. I had no degree, but I had learned a lot. My long and winding road was leading me home, and I hoped that, as the Beatles sang in Hey Jude, I could at least take a sad song and make it better. After spending most of the first term working on the Connecticut Senate campaign of Joe Duffy, a peace candidate, I settled into law school life, cramming for exams, getting to know some of the other students, and enjoying my house and my housemates. Then one day, when I was sitting at the back of Professor Emerson's class in political and civil rights, I spotted a woman I hadn't seen before. She had thick, dark blonde hair and wore eyeglasses and no makeup, but she conveyed a sense of strength and self-possession I had rarely seen in anyone, man or woman. After class, I followed her out, intending to introduce myself. When I got a couple of feet from her, I reached out my hand to touch her shoulder, then immediately pulled it back. It was almost a physical reaction. Somehow I knew that this wasn't another tap on the shoulder, and that I might be starting something I couldn't stop. I saw the girl several times around school over the next few days, but didn't approach her. Then one night, I was standing at one end of the long, narrow Yale Law Library, talking to another student, Jeff Gleckel, about joining the Yale Law Journal. Jeff urged me to do it, saying it would assure me a good clerkship with a federal judge or a job with one of the blue-chip law firms. He made a good case, but I just wasn't interested. I was going home to Arkansas, and in the meantime, preferred politics to the law review. After a while, I suddenly stopped paying attention to his earnest entreaty because I saw the girl again, standing at the other end of the long, narrow room. For once, she was staring back at me. After a while, she closed her book, walked the length of the library, looked me in the eye, and said, "If you're going to keep staring at me, and I'm going to keep staring back, we ought to at least know each other's names. Mine's Hillary Rodham. What's yours?" Hillary, of course, remembers all this, but in slightly different words. I was impressed, and so stunned I couldn't say anything for a few seconds. Finally, I blurted my name out. We exchanged a few words, and she left. I don't know what poor Jeff Gleckel thought was going on, but he never talked to me about the law review again. A couple of days later, I was coming down the steps to the ground floor of the law school when I saw Hillary again. She was wearing a bright flowered skirt that nearly touched the floor. I was determined to spend some time with her. She said she was going to register for next term's classes, so I said I'd go too. We stood in line and talked. I thought I was doing pretty well, until we got to the front of the line. The registrar looked up at me and said, "Bill, what are you doing back here? You registered this morning." I turned beet red, and Hillary laughed, that big laugh of hers. My cover was blown. So I asked her to take a walk with me to the Yale Art Gallery to see the Mark Rothko exhibit. I was so eager and nervous that I forgot the university workforce was on strike and the museum was closed. Luckily, there was a guard on duty. I pleaded my case and offered to clean up the branches and other litter in the museum's garden if he'd let us in. The guard took a look at us, figured it out, and let us in. We had the whole exhibit to ourselves. It was wonderful, and I've liked Rothko ever since. When we were done, we went out to the garden and I picked up the sticks. I suppose I was being a scab for the first and only time in my life. But the union didn't have a picket line outside the museum, and besides, politics was the last thing on my mind. After I paid my cleaning-up dues, Hillary and I stayed in the garden for another hour or so. There was a large, beautiful Henry Moore sculpture of a seated woman. Hillary sat in the woman's lap, and I sat beside her talking. Before long, without thinking, I leaned over and laid my head in her lap. It was our first date. We spent the next several days together, just hanging around, talking about everything under the sun. By mid-May, I wanted to be with Hillary all the time, but time was running out on us. Hillary had accepted a summer job at Truhaf, Walker & Bernstein, a law firm in Oakland, California, and I had been asked to take a job as coordinator of the Southern States for Senator George McGovern's presidential campaign. Until I met Hillary, I was really looking forward to it. I was going to be based in Miami, and the job required traveling throughout the South, putting state campaigns together. I knew I'd be good at it, and though I didn't think McGovern could do very well in the general election in the South, I believed he could win a fair number of convention delegates during the primary season. Regardless, I'd have the political experience of a lifetime. It was a rare opportunity for a 25-year-old, one I got from a combination of my friendship with Rick Stearns, who had an important post in the campaign, and affirmative action. They had to have at least one Southerner in a responsible position. The problem was, I no longer wanted to do it. I knew if I went to Florida, Hillary and I might be lost to each other. Though I found the prospect of the campaign exciting, I feared, as I wrote in my diary, that it would simply be a way of formalizing my aloneness, letting me deal with people in a good cause, but at arm's length. With Hillary, there was no arm's length. She was in my face from the start, and before I knew it, in my heart. I screwed up my courage and asked Hillary if I could spend the summer with her in California. She was incredulous at first, because she knew how much I loved politics and how deeply I felt about the war. I told her I'd have the rest of my life for my work and my ambition, but I loved her and wanted to see if it could work out for us. She took a deep breath and agreed to let me take her to California. We had been together only about a month. When the summer ended, Hillary and I decided to live together back in New Haven, a move that doubtless caused both our families concern. We found an apartment on the ground floor of an old house at 21 Edgewood Avenue near the law school. I really got into my third semester of law school with courses in corporate finance, criminal procedure, taxation, estates, and a seminar in corporate social responsibility. In addition to my classwork, I had two jobs. Even with a scholarship and two different student loans, I needed the money. I worked a few hours a week for Ben Moss, a local lawyer, doing legal research and running errands. My other job was teaching criminal law to undergraduates in a law enforcement program at the University of New Haven. My position was funded under the Federal Law Enforcement Assistance Program, which had just started under President Nixon. The classes were designed to produce more professional law officers who could make arrests, searches, and seizures in a constitutional manner. After working for George McGovern at the Democratic Convention in Miami, I went to Texas to help coordinate the general election campaign there. I knew it was going to be tough when I flew from Washington to Arkansas to pick up a car. I sat next to a young man from Jackson, Mississippi, who asked me what I was doing. When I told him, he almost shouted, "You're the only white person I've ever met from McGovern." Later, when I was home watching John Dean testify about the misdeeds of the Nixon White House before Senator Sam Ervin's Watergate Committee, the phone rang. It was that young man whom I'd met on the airplane. He said, "I just called so you could say, I told you so." I never heard from him again, but I appreciated the call.